Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 205, Healing Troubled Relationships, with David Burns, MD. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Now the book has sold 5 million copies, and cognitive therapy has become, you know, probably the most widely practiced and researched form of psychotherapy in the world. But I really don't consider myself a cognitive therapist or any other school of therapy. I'm in favor of tools, not schools of therapy. And I think all the schools of therapy have had important discoveries and important angles. But the problem is they're headed up, you know, kind of by gurus who push too hard, trying to say cognitive therapy is the answer to everything, or rational emotive therapy is the answer to everything, or psychoanalysis is the answer to everything. And that's reductionism and kind of foolish thinking, to my point of view.
That was the voice of my guest, David Burns, MD. Dr. David Burns is an adjunct clinical professor emeritus of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine, and has served as visiting scholar at the Harvard Medical School. He's certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. His best-selling book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, has sold over 5 million copies worldwide and is the book most frequently prescribed by American and Canadian mental health professionals for patients suffering from depression. His latest book, Feeling Good Together, was released in January of 2009 and focuses on the causes of and cures for relationship problems. Dr. Burns has appeared on numerous radio and television shows and has won many awards for his research and teaching. He's been named Teacher of the Year on 3 occasions by the graduating residents at the Stanford Medical School. Now, here's the interview. Dr. David Burns, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be on your show. I think you're doing terrific work, and I'm very flattered to have the chance to appear.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you here. You've written 10 books, and I'm embarrassed to say I was unaware of your work until it was brought to my attention by Sean Williams, a young therapist who's one of my listeners and also one of your supervisees. So I'm really glad to have discovered you. Let's start out with a bit about your background. What drew you into psychiatry in the first place?
Well, I came in kind of through the back door. I was not a pre-medical student. I was a philosophy major at Amherst College. And my senior year, I did my honors thesis on a book by Ludwig Wittgenstein called Philosophical Investigations. One of my roommates, a brilliant physics major, suggested it, Phil Allen, and he was, so smart. I figured, well, if he thinks this is the end thing, you know, I better do it. And that book came out in 1950, and now many people view it as the greatest book in the history of philosophy. Wittgenstein really solved all the problems of philosophy. Sadly, he was so horribly depressed during his lifetime that he thought his work was rubbish. He never published a thing, and it was based on some notes they found in a metal box under his bed at Oxford University, and they put it together as a series of numbered paragraphs, and it was a phenomenal book. Very few people could understand it at first, and I couldn't understand it at all. I didn't know what he was talking about, and then spring of my senior year, I was walking across the Amherst campus, and it dawned on me the point he was making, and I suddenly saw the solution to all the problems of philosophy, and it was a fantastic thing. And so I went to my advisor and said, you know, I'm not going to go to graduate school in philosophy because there's no point now. And and so I'm thinking maybe I'll do psychology, and because I took a psychology class or two and really loved it. He says, oh, no, you've got to go to medical school and become a psychiatrist instead. I said, why? And he said, well, drugs are going to be real big, and psychiatrists can prescribe drugs, and otherwise it's similar to a psychologist. And I said, but I'm not a pre-medical student. I haven't had a biology class or anything. And he said, oh, well, don't worry about that. He says, you can talk your way into anything. And, all right, so I applied to medical schools and got into Stanford Medical School, and I was like a fish out of water.
With no pre-med?
Had nothing in common with the students, but struggled through and became a psychiatrist. So that's how I became a psychiatrist.
And you did it with no pre-med?
Not really, no.
Wow.
I'd had some physics. I was a philosophy of science major, and I'd had some, you know, math and physics and some things like that, but I hadn't had a single biology class. But I used an interviewing technique that I've described in my book, The Feeling Good Handbook, and I've helped a lot of patients who have, you know, social anxiety and shyness and, you know, don't know how to interview for jobs and things. There's a kind of a technique you can use if you're being interviewed for a job, and it'll make everyone chase after you. I've taught all my students that too when they graduate and go looking for jobs or academic positions, and it works like a charm. That's what I used to get into the Stanford Medical School.
Well, I think everybody's who's listening is going to scurry off and look for your book now, because that sounds like quite a key.
You want to hear how it worked?
Well, sure.
That's probably off the subject of the interview, but it's kind of a fun thing, and there is a take-home message there. You know, a lot of times people with social anxiety, they're so worried trying to impress other people, and then you get all nervous and kind of turn people off because people really, you know, care about themselves.
Right.
And so when I went to Stanford for my interview for medical school, I was interviewed by the chief of anatomy, and I didn't want him to talk much about me to find out, you know, that I knew nothing about biology or whatever. And so he interviewed me in the basement of the Stanford Museum, and that's where they did the, you know, dissect the cadavers and stuff like that. And it was dark down there, and I said, wow, you know, it's kind of creepy down here. What's it like working down here? And he said, oh, no, it's not creepy. It's a lot of fun. And I said, oh really? Well, what do you do? He said, oh, my laboratory is right down the hall here. And I said, well, could you show me your laboratory? And he says, all right, I would love to. So he showed me in there. I think he was kind of lonely, maybe. And I said, well, what? Oh, you've got one of these machines. I didn't know what it was. Some new, whatever, chemical, you know, whatever, high-powered thing. And oh, he started talking about this machine. I said, well, tell me how you use this in research. That's really cool. Sounds like you're doing some great work. And we talked and talked. I just kept asking him about himself and you know, throwing some compliments out there. And after a while, he looked at his watch. He says, my gosh, we've been talking for nearly 2 hours. This was supposed to be a 15-minute appointment. And he says, I've got to get to a meeting over at the medical school. He said, here, you can walk with me part way over there. And we walked out of the building. He put his hand on my shoulder. He says, well, young man, you know, I forgot to ask what your name was. And I said, oh, well, my name is David Burns. I'm from Amherst College. And he says, well, David Burns, I want you to know that you're the kind of young man we need here at the Stanford Medical School.
That's great.
And that sounded pretty good. I said, well, yeah, but the problem is I probably won't be able to attend. I'm really sorry. And he says, well, why is that? Is Harvard making you a better offer? Well, I'll do any offer Harvard can make. And I said, well, no, not really. But you see, my father's a minister, and we don't have any money. And I've heard it costs like as much as $100,000 to go to medical school. And I'd have to borrow it, but my father's a Lutheran minister, and he believes that borrowing money is a sin, so there's no way I could come here. And he says, don't you worry, David Burns. I'm the head of the, you know, the admissions committee, and I'm going to the meeting right now, and you're going to get a letter in the mail tomorrow stating you're our first top choice for the Stanford Medical School, and we're going to offer you all expenses paid the whole time you're here. It will not cost you a penny. You're coming to the Stanford Medical School, and that's the end of the argument. I said, well, that's an offer I can't refuse. So.
Wow.
The rest is history. They might have regretted admitting me. once they found out what a horrible medical student I was, but I'm on the faculty now, on the voluntary faculty. I'm trying to, you know, pay them back and you know, repay my debt for them putting up with me and making me a doctor.
Wow, that's a marvelous story. What if you hadn't become a doctor or a psychotherapist? Was there some other career path that called to you?
Well,
as
I
well?
Think psychology. I mean, people think I'm a psychologist. I had an article in Psychology Today magazine, The Perfectionist Script for Self-Defeat, and they described me as a psychologist because the paradox, I started out as a biological psychiatrist doing brain research at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School after my residency, and then got totally involved in psychotherapy and psychological research, and I really function much more as a psychologist. I've kind of turned away from this heavy movement in psychiatry of pushing drugs, drugs, drugs. As if that's going to cure everything. And I did that for several years, but I think it was grossly oversold. And now I think a lot of the research is coming out showing that the psychiatric medicines, especially the antidepressants, they probably don't have the safety and efficacy that we've been led to believe by the pharmaceutical companies and by the psychiatric profession. But I may be steering you away from the topic of the interview, although I think these are tremendously important and exciting topics as well.
They definitely are. You know, you and I might have crossed paths earlier because I ended up at Sonoma State University for my first job and stayed there for my whole career. But the other choice was Amherst College.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. I enjoyed Amherst. It was great on critical thinking, something I think is lacking in our field. And one of the reasons I've enjoyed, I just heard one of your radio interviews for the first time, was the professor, I think he was from Berkeley, who was into dissociative disorders and
yes,
childhood trauma. And he was a critical thinker and a researcher. And it was just like music to my ears. And there's so much of that is lacking in our field because it's just like all cults of, psychotherapy competing like religious cults or something, everybody claiming to have the answer and very little, science. And so what I've been trying to do in my, work at Stanford and teaching research is develop a true science of psychotherapy, high-speed treatment methods that are based on what really works rather than the latest fad to come down the pike.
Yes. Well, I'm wondering, as a psychotherapist, do you subscribe to a certain theoretical orientation?
Well, you know, I began in cognitive therapy and kind of helped to pioneer cognitive therapy in the 1970s and did a lot of the early, work in developing many of the methods. Of course, Ellis and Beck were the real pioneers. But I think my book, Feeling Good, probably has made a lot of the world aware of cognitive therapy. When I wrote it, when it was published in 1980, very few people had ever heard of cognitive therapy. And now the book has sold 5 million copies, and cognitive therapy has become, probably the most widely practiced and researched form of psychotherapy in the world. But I really don't consider myself a cognitive therapist or any other school of therapy. I'm in favor of tools, not schools of therapy. And I think all the schools of therapy have had important discoveries and important angles, but the problem is they're headed up, kind of by gurus who push too hard trying to say cognitive therapy is the answer to everything, or rational emotive therapy is the answer to everything, or psychoanalysis is the answer to everything, and that's reductionism and kind of foolish thinking to my point of view. And I think we need to find to capitalize on all these schools and integrate the best insights and bring them to bear for each person that we use. I use and train my students in 50 basic psychotherapy techniques, and many of them are cognitive. I think cognitive therapy techniques are mind-blowing, but we use paradoxical techniques, motivational techniques, even some psychodynamic techniques, exposure techniques, behavioral techniques. We use the measurement model. Integrate many of the whole Rogerian thing, empathy, warmth, trust. I mean, these are all incredibly important dimensions of effective therapy. And I think the therapists who join these cults are really barking up the wrong tree.
Well, I totally agree. I've certainly always been very eclectic myself, and I love your phrase, tools, not schools. And I think that as psychology has evolved, and psychiatry perhaps as well, I hope, is in fact evolving somewhat away from that sort of competing cults, if you will, and more focus on pragmatics, on what works.
I don't know about that. Every week I get a book in the mail, some new school of therapy is formed that's got the answer to everything. It's CBT, DBT, TFT, ACT, LSMFT. Coming down the pike and people want to join up. I think it's going to be a tough trend to overcome. I hope we can overcome it and focus on process research, which I think is vitally important. Outcome research is, I think, of modest importance. I think process research can lead the way to the future, finding out what are the ingredients of therapeutic success or failure. And that's, although I've spent most of my life as a clinician, I've done a lot of process research for journals like Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology or Journal of Abnormal Psychology and others to try to find out what is it that really makes for effective therapy? What is the true cause of most therapeutic failure? And then to try to distill the therapy of the future to create a new psychotherapy that's based on what really works, what really heals people. We're looking for high-speed recovery now from depression and anxiety disorders and relationship conflicts as well. And while we can't always bring that about, we're seeing much more frequently than even as little as 5 or 10 years ago. And I'm talking about people really recovering within 1 or 2 or 3 sessions, not, 1 or 2 or 3 months or many years.
That's great. Well, I want to drill down in one of your most recent books. As I've mentioned, you've written 10 books. And today I'd like to focus on your most recent one, which came out this January, and is called Feeling Good Together. And let me say at the outset that you definitely have a gift for writing in a clear and engaging style. Now, aside from the enormous success of Feeling Good, what prompted you to write Feeling Good Together?
Well, I was first supposed to publish that book in 1981, because when Feeling Good came out, the publishers, thought it would be a loser book. It wouldn't promote it, and then it started selling, and they had to keep reprinting it just because people who picked it up, a lot of them were helped by it, and so they would say, get this book, and to other people, and therapists started recommending that, and pretty soon the publisher saw, hey, we've got something here on our hands that looks like it's going to be very good from a commercial point of view, and so then they said, hey, we want another book, and the Feeling Good was on Cognitive Therapy for Depression, and it was the big thing in those days, and it was like a new breakthrough approach that was dramatically helpful for many people. So we started thinking, oh, we'll try it for all these other problems as well, and for anxiety and relationship problems. And so I wrote this book and sent it to my editors called Couples in Conflict, Couples in Love, and it was kind of the cognitive behavioral approach to marital therapy, to couples therapy, and it was based on the idea that people with troubled relationships have these distorted thoughts and poor interpersonal skills, like poor negotiating skills, poor communicating skills, all this type of thing, and that we could just train them to correct these distorted perceptions and unrealistic expectations and train them to negotiate more skillfully and to communicate more skillfully. And that then, lo and behold, they'd gladly use these new tools and have loving relationships. And I sent it to my editor, and she called me 2 days later, Maria. She was a wonderful person, and New York all the way. Oh, darling, we got this book. It's wonderful. Sure to be number one bestseller. This type of thing. She was just over the top with the euphoria and said, we're going to send you a contract and $150,000 advance. And this,
wow.
This is fantastic. But I started noticing, so I got that money, put it in the bank, I was all happy, but started noticing that the techniques didn't work very well. It was a whole different kettle of fish than with the treating depression and anxiety disorders, where almost everybody was recovering, and most of them, rather quickly and dramatically and
yes.
Totally. And but I wasn't seeing that with troubled couples and with people who were angry. And so I called my editor and said, let's just hold off 6 months before we, you know, get this thing into the pipeline. I just want to get a few more vignettes, you know, treat a few more couples. Well, now it's 6 months later, I've treated 50 more couples, and the number who have recovered are about zero. And I began to think, you know, this stuff sounds great on paper, but it's BS in reality. This whole approach does not work. And we're missing something vitally important, and I don't care if it is a number one bestseller. I'm not going to publish something that isn't true.
Well, good for you.
And so I called my editor. I said, this is breaking my heart, Maria, but I'm going to send that $150,000 back and break the contract. Because the whole idea of using cognitive behavioral therapy to treat troubled relationships is not sound. And it's not surprising either, because in medicine you can't treat everything with penicillin. You have hundreds of treatments. So why should we have a treatment that should work for all psychological problems? And then I said, I'm not going to publish that book until I find the real cause of, marital problems, relationship problems, anger, human conflict, through research and clinical work, and come up with a radically new and different method that is effective. And that's what took, 25 years waiting to publish, the book Feeling Good Together. And the other thing that held me back was that once I saw what was really the problem with troubled relationships, I realized, this is a message that the general public probably isn't going to want to hear. And how can I possibly write this book and package it in a way that anyone's going to want to buy it or read it? That the truth is the truth about why people have troubled relationships is going to blow people's mind and going to kind of irritate people and upset people. And that held me back as well.
Okay, well, let's get into it a little bit. At the outset, you suggest there are two major sets of theories relating to relationship difficulties, marital difficulties, but also other kinds of troubled relationships. And you group them into deficit theories and motivational theories. And you point out that most marital therapists draw upon the deficit model. So tell us about the deficit model.
Well, the deficit model is a wonderfully optimistic way of viewing human nature. Most therapists are kind of liberal in their thinking and idealistic, and, I'm that way to a great extent, too. But the idea is human beings are basically good and want love and joy and productive relationships, and the only reason we get into troubled relationships and hostility and violence and conflict is because we don't have the tools. We have some kind of deficit that prevents us from achieving that goal. And so hostility and violence and defensiveness and hatred are artifacts that result from this thwarted desire for love and intimacy and joy and happiness. And so all these deficit theories try to give people the tools that they're lacking to make up the deficits. So we'll have, healthier attitudes and better communication skills. And then we'll use these to develop loving relationships. And the problem with those theories, there's all different deficits that people have speculated about, like this men are from Venus, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, that type of theory, the idea that, women communicate about feelings and use language to convey, to develop intimacy, and men use language to solve problems and to do mechanical things, and that's these deficits in understanding how the other sex communicates. That's the cause of marital problems. And the problem with all of these theories, they sound good on paper, but if you have a research base and test them, you can easily show that all of these are false theories. I recently published a paper with one of my Stanford psychology fellows, who's now a professor at BYU, Diane Spangler. Is it true that men are from Mars and women are from Venus? And we tested this theory with a fairly large database using structural modeling techniques and saw that, there's no validity to the theory at all. That's not the cause of marital problems, and it's not even true that women, do so well handling emotions, their own or anyone else's. These are human problems that we all have. But I'm babbling too much here, but to make a long story short, all those therapies based on the deficit theory have been shown in outcome studies not to be effective. In fact, every form of marital therapy and couples therapy practice in the world today has been shown in controlled outcome studies to be hardly effective at all. There is no effective couples therapy or marital therapy, in my opinion, in the world. And that's based on Don Balcom's review of the world literature, which he does practically every year, saying how effective are all these forms of marital therapy in the short term and in the long term. And the answer is barely more effective than placebo interventions, if at all. And so All of those deficit theories, you know, they sound great. But it's just false. Now, the motivational theory is quite different and is based on the idea that there's two sides to human nature, not just one, and that we have inherently positive loving drives, but also inherently hostile, aggressive, a dark side to human nature.
Yeah, this particularly caught my attention as someone with a long interest in Jungian psychology. As I'm sure you know, Carl Jung believed that we're not all good, but that good and evil exist.
I don't know much about Jung, but when I heard that, I said, God, this guy and I, we're on the same page. That's vital.
Yeah, and of course, Freud thought that we're largely driven by rather negative unconscious forces.
Yeah.
So you have your own take on the dark side, so to speak.
Yeah, I resonate with both of those, both of them for that reason. But it's not so popular these days to think that way.
Yeah, I guess you haven't been on Oprah with this idea.
I'm waiting for her phone call. I'm ready to fly out wherever she is.
Yeah, you actually have a chapter titled "Why We Secretly Love to Hate."
Yeah,
tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's just based on the idea, and again, people don't necessarily want to hear this, but when we're in conflict, we kind of cling to that conflict, almost like a bulldog will cling to a piece of meat because it tastes good. We there's something about a conflict that's very addictive to people. When I think we can say exactly what it is that's addictive about it, but that's the dark side. That's why we get into problems. In that chapter, I talk about a couple with a horribly troubled relationship where the man is smashing the woman in the mouth every week. I wasn't allowed to put that in the book, by the way, because the editor thought, you know, that's too heavy. The general public can't take the truth. I said, I don't believe we should whitewash everything. Why don't we tell it like it is? But they wouldn't. They made me edit that out. But
interesting.
There's a very troubled relationship, and you know, you ask yourself, well, is this true according to this deficit theory? You know, is this man smashing his wife in the mouth? And, you know, practically raping her for sex because he doesn't have the tools to develop tenderness and intimacy? I don't think so. I think it's because he likes to hurt her, because he's addicted to power and control. And you know, from his point of view, he doesn't have a troubled relationship. He has a solution.
Wow.
You know, he gets together with his buddies and brags about what bitches women are and how they have to be put in their place.
Yes.
And then you see him, you say, oh, well, he's a loser. He's a jerk. But I believe this exists in all of us. When I do workshops, I say, let's do a little thought experiment. Maybe the listeners of the radio show can do this right now, or the podcast, whatever this is. I say, think about one person who you don't like or get along with very well. Someone who you kind of resent, maybe someone who's hurt you, someone who's narcissistic and exploitative, someone who won't express their feelings, or someone who's hypercritical or demanding, or someone who always has to be right. And so when you thought of someone, you know, put your hand up in the air. So then all the hands go up. Everyone's thinking of someone, and I too am thinking of someone, a colleague who I don't really much care for. And I say, now imagine there's a magic button on your desk. If you press that magic button, that person who you can't stand will suddenly become your best friend in the whole world with no effort at all on your own part. No price to be paid. How many of you are going to press that button? Then everyone laughs, and maybe out of a group of 200 or 300, you'll see three or four hands go up. certainly my hand doesn't go up. And I said, that's the point I'm trying to make. You see, you're all choosing hostile relationships over love and intimacy. You would prefer to have a bad relationship with that person. And I'm not judging you. I don't want to get close to the person I'm at odds with who I'm thinking about either. I don't trust him. I don't like him. I think he's exploitative. And I want to keep my distance. But there is something very addictive and very attractive to us about having people to look down on, people to blame, people to try to get back at. And that's the piece that I think couples therapists, marital therapists perhaps have not been taking into account. That's why I call it the motivational model. The real problem relationship is to get close to other people, but rather that we don't want to. Because there's a side of our nature that is attracted to the dark side.
Yes. Now, along with the uncomfortable thing that you point out, that marriage therapy on the whole doesn't have a very good track record, what about the work of someone like Dr. John Gottman? Hasn't his research given us any additional purchase on effective marital therapy?
Well, maybe you'll have to edit this out. I haven't followed his work. I did ask a colleague, has he done some outcome studies? Does he have some tools? And the colleague wasn't aware of any outcome studies he's done of any therapies that he's created. I think he's done some nice research. I think he's written a nice book I have here on time series analysis. I do mathematical modeling for Stanford's New Brain Research Center, and I do a lot of statistics with with a younger colleague, Scott Hall, and we're studying, brain development in normal and mentally retarded children, developing mathematical models to try to understand this a little bit better. But so I love research, and Gottman has done some great statistical work, and I know he has a great following, but I'm not aware, of actual marital therapy techniques he has developed, and I'm not aware of any outcome studies he's done showing effective marital therapy techniques. But I could be all wet, so maybe this is a part of the interview to edit out, because I'm not the one to ask about him.
Okay, and I can't fill you in either. I don't remember the details. I just know that he's considered one of the prominent researchers in the field. You've studied over 1,000 people with unhappy or troubled relationships in order to pinpoint the factors that distinguish successful from failing relationships. What did that study show? Why do so many marriages end up in bitterness and divorce? And what's the most toxic factor?
Well, to make a long story short, is that people who blame others for their relationship problems, that seems to be the one causal factor that accounts for the lion's share of the variance in marital satisfaction or marital dissatisfaction. I study all kinds of other factors that people were theorizing to be, causes of marital problems, patterns of attitudes, a submissive wife and a dominant, controlling husband, and all kinds of things that people said this should be associated with a good or bad marriage. And none of those patterns were. But what really came out was, if you're saying my partner or the other person, whoever it is to blame for the problems in this relationship, then you're going to have a lousy relationship in the here and now. And furthermore, that attitude will predict changes in relationship satisfaction when controlling for current levels of relationship satisfaction and dissatisfaction. So not only will you have a lousy relationship now, it'll get worse in the future. And in contrast, people who said, it's my job to make my partner happy, it's my job to pinpoint my role in this problem and to focus on changing myself rather than blaming my partner, they were rare, but those were the people who had the most joyous, loving relationships now and were able to handle conflict and problems in the future without a deterioration in the quality of their relationship. And this has turned out to be a variable of just overwhelming importance. But it's not trivial because, again, when I'm working with workshop audiences and say, now, again, think of the person who you're in conflict with. Let's say you did want to have a better relationship with them. What price are you going to have to pay that you're probably not going to be willing to pay? And then this comes to the whole thing of blame. I say, how many of you in your heart of hearts, who do you think is more to blame for the problems in this relationship? You or the other person? Who do you think is the bigger jerk? You or the other person? And then, of course, everybody says, oh, the other person. And then I say, what's the prognosis for developing a more loving relationship with your patient or with yourself when the person is saying it's the other person's fault? And the answer to that is the prognosis is zero. I know of no tools in the world powerful enough to help someone or to help a nation, for that matter, who says it's someone else's fault when you're blaming other people. That, to me, is the toxic cause of most, 90% of relationship problems and failure.
That's fascinating to me because, again, it brings to mind both the Jungian approach and also sort of mindfulness approaches that are kind of rooted in Eastern thought and Buddhism, to the effect of the importance of owning one's projections.
Yeah, well, I love what you're saying, and there's a lot of Buddhism in the book, Feeling Good Together, and in my thinking. I'm not a Buddhist. I don't ever read anything about Buddhism, but the Buddhist concepts are very rich and mind-blowing, and they come to life when you're doing couples therapy or individual therapy, for that matter. And one of the concepts that the Buddhists talk about, and of course the Christians do too, and the Jews do, most religions, is the great death. Death and rebirth, the death of the ego. And I'm convinced that to get close to someone you're at odds with is not only a psychological concept, but a spiritual concept. And that involves the death of the ego. And if you're willing to die, you can kind of go to heaven, but that's not after your physical body dies. Death has to happen, can happen every day, many times a day, when you're criticized by someone you love, someone you care about, you feel hurt. Instead of defending yourself, to find truth in what they're saying, to see the world through their eyes, and to let your ego die, we shy away from it. Nobody wants to die. We want to live, but the desire to live causes your relationships to fail, causes you to suffer. And once you let go, then a new world can open up of joy and intimacy. Now, of course, what I'm saying is like bullshit. It's just some philosophical notions. What I've tried to do in Feeling Good Together is develop specific step-by-step practical techniques that can reveal these things to people and rather quickly, in a shocking way, I might say. But in order to use the tools in that book, humility is going to be very important. And I have no doubt that many readers will turn away from it, just as, human beings have turned away from religious concepts for thousands of years. It kind of sounds good on one level, but when it comes to applying it in one's personal life, that can be quite painful.
Yes, well, you've developed an approach, and I'm remembering how you're talking about all these approaches coming down the pike, but you've developed an approach that you call cognitive interpersonal therapy, and you can tell us about that. You say it's based on three ideas that can change your life. So what are those three fundamental ideas?
Number one is that we're always causing the problems that we're complaining about in our relationships with other people, but we're unaware of it. And so we see ourselves as victims because we can't see our role. We can't see how we're actually triggering that very behavior in the person we're not getting along with. That's principle number one. Principle number two is we don't want to see that. We're in a state of self-deception or self-denial because it is so painful and humiliating to suddenly see that we've been pushing the person away and causing the lack of intimacy that has been causing us so much pain, and that the finger of blame is really pointing directly at us. And those are very negative aspects of human nature. The third is the positive message. If we're willing to give up blaming the other person and focus instead on pinpointing our own role in the problem and focus all our energies on changing ourselves, you can transform troubled relationships into loving, trusting ones, often with remarkable speed. And I'm talking about in, less than a minute in many cases. But in order to do that, a price is going to have to be paid, and that's not only learning some tools that are fairly sophisticated but exciting, but also being willing to see something about yourself that's going to be very painful.
Yes, yes. Now, you also talk about the 5 secrets of effective communication. So if we promise not to tell anyone else, can you share the 5 secrets with us now?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're really neat, and they're fun to practice. I practice them in workshops with mental health professionals and also with the general public, and they sound very simple, but they're quite challenging to learn in reality. There's 3 listening skills called the disarming technique, thought and feeling empathy, and inquiry. And then there's an assertiveness skill called I feel statements, and then the last thing is respect, conveying respect to the other person, and I think of them as EAR, you know, empathy skills, assertiveness skills, and conveying respect. The most important of all of them, by far, but the hardest to learn, is called the disarming technique, and that means finding truth in what the critic is saying, even if what the critic is saying seems illogical, preposterous, an unfair attack on you, an unfair criticism, something that's totally illogical and unrealistic. And so you'll want to defend yourself, and the disarming technique is based on the law of opposites. And that's that if you defend yourself from a harsh, unfair, illogical criticism, the moment you defend yourself, you'll prove that the critic was right all along. And that's a paradox. If you defend yourself from a false criticism, you'll prove that the criticism was actually valid. That's a paradox. And the other side is also true of the paradox, is if you instantly and genuinely find truth in a totally unfair and preposterous criticism, the moment you agree with it, you'll put the lie to it, and the other person will stop believing it.
Interesting.
And we could take an example, you know, if you want to try to bring it to life or go in whatever direction you want, but that's the disarming technique. Thought and feeling empathy, thought empathy is paraphrasing what the other person said so you can, they'll see that you got the message. Feeling empathy is acknowledging how they're probably feeling. Given what they said, they're probably feeling hurt and angry and ticked off.
Yeah, this sounds like the part that comes from Rogers.
Yes, yes, that's right. That's right. Although, surprisingly, mental health professionals can't do it. They can't do it on stage in role plays. They can't do it in behind closed doors. There's 2 kinds of emotions that no mental health professional in the United States or Canada has ever been able to acknowledge, and that's their own feelings or those of their patients. That sounds so absurd to say, people, oh, Burns doesn't know what he's talking about, but we do a lot of role plays and workshops trying to train therapists in these basic skills they thought they knew, you know, how to do, and surprisingly, few or none of them can do it at first. And I've developed an intimacy exercise, kind of a training exercise for the general public or therapists to develop these skills they thought they were so good at but really aren't. And you can learn and get up to speed if you're willing to practice and you know, experience a little embarrassment when you see how inadequate your skills are.
Wow.
And then, you know, inquiries, asking gentle probing questions to learn more about where the other person's coming from and how they're feeling. And then I feel statements is sharing your own feelings in an open, diplomatic and kind of gentle way so the person will see you're real. You know, maybe you're feeling anxious or awkward or uncomfortable, and instead of hiding those feelings, you know, to share them. And then stroking means to convey respect even in the heat of battle. You know, you're allowed to be angry. The other person's allowed to be angry as well. But you can either share your anger or you can attack with your anger in an overtly aggressive way or a passive aggressive way. So anyway, those are the 5 secrets, and they sound kind of simple in a way, but they can be spectacularly powerful and quite challenging to learn. They're a little harder, you know. It might say, like, these are the 5 keys of the piano, but you can't just sit down and start banging on the keys and expect to make beautiful music. You've got to work at it and practice it and master the tools.
Yes, I think somewhere you make the observation that the achieving intimacy is not easy. It really takes work.
Yeah, it's not only takes work and a lot of effort to learn how to do it, to learn to use these tools, but as I mentioned earlier, to be willing to swallow your pride and to see the thing through the other person's eyes. It's pretty hard to do that because when someone is criticizing you, they're virtually always telling you something that's true that you don't want to see. And If you defend yourself, the relationship will go downhill. If with warmth and respect you acknowledge the truth in the criticism, you can transform the relationship almost instantly. But it involves death, and most people don't want to die, and as a result we suffer.
Yes.
I don't know what direction we should go in just at the moment. I love your questions.
Okay, well, we began the discussion with the uncomfortable news that marital therapy tends not to work particularly well. What evidence do you have that your approach improves on the odds?
You know, I don't. As a clinician, I'm not in a position to do outcome research very well, very easily. My focus has been on process research to try to distill from longitudinal data collected in my clinical work and then surveys from the general public. What are the causes of this or that problem, and what are the things that are associated with the success or failure in trying to help people recover? But I don't have that data yet, and I don't know. But I do think that in our work with depression, with anxiety, and with relationship problems, we need to begin to have outcome studies that take motivational factors into account, because one of the things that I've learned has been I don't know how to treat people against their will. And before you can use any techniques, you've got to see what would it be worth to the person if I could show you how to change your life and how to develop intimacy or how to develop depression or whatever you're suffering with. What would you bring to the table? And then let's look at some of the reasons why you might not want to change. And maybe you can persuade me that we should work together, or maybe you'll decide that that you don't want to change this or that problem. That's the new tool that we've been developing and refining my psychotherapy development group at Stanford, and it's, you know, we're seeing in the area of depression and anxiety phenomenally fast recovery now. But whether the same will be true for anger and hostility and relationship problems, I don't know. Suppose you went to Palestine or Israel. You said, hey, we've got some fabulous new techniques to, you know, show you people in Israel how to love the people in Palestine and to have wonderful relationships with them. Or say to the people in Palestine, you know, we can show you how to have wonderful, loving relationship with the Jews in Israel. What are they going to say? Hey, that's not what we had in mind. We're not looking for that. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So on a level, before you can say something is effective, you have to say, what does the person want? What are they trying to achieve? What would it be worth to them to change this or that troubled relationship? And maybe there will be times where people will step away and say, no, I don't want to get close to that person. And so then any kind of study of effectiveness, to my way of thinking, would be a moot point.
Well, even though you don't have outcome studies yet, I have the sense that you feel you're moving in an you're optimistic about the direction in which you're moving now. Would that be correct?
Yes. Oh, yes. We're very excited by the techniques, and the therapists can use them to transform their relationships with patients, and people can use them in their personal lives to transform your relationship with your spouse, with your son you're not getting along with, your sister. The tremendous things can be done, but again, we have to respect the fact that human beings may not want that. Sometimes, and it's so sad, people may choose a troubled relationship, and it's so hard for mental health professionals to get this. I was treating one of my students I supervise a lot of psychology fellows at Stanford and PsyD students and psychiatric residents. I just love working with them and learn from them. And one of my students, one of my favorite students, was treating a woman who was divorced, and she would whine and complain about what a loser her husband was. And she was very attractive and, and a successful attorney, had trouble with men. You know, men would chase after her, but she would treat them shabbily, and of course, then they'd fall more deeply in love with her because of the shabby treatment she gave them. And the more they chased her, the more she'd lose respect for them, so she couldn't get close to men. And one day she was talking about, you know, to see the children, and she picked him up at the airport, and she was talking about what a loser he was to her therapist, who was my student. and whining and complaining, and my students saw very well how defensive and hostile she was, and how she was kind of creating as a self-fulfilling prophecy the horrible relationships with her ex-husband and with men that she was complaining about. And so he said to her, you know, I have some wonderful new communication techniques, and I'd love to help you and show you how to change the way you relate to your ex-husband, the way you communicate with him and with men. She got very huffy and indignant and said, I communicate just fine with men. No thanks. And the error he made was, again, thinking that somehow she wanted loving relationships. What could be better than have an ex-spouse to beat up on and to complain about? Don't take that away from me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the issue I think we've got to be looking at in outcome studies of any type of interpersonal therapy. How is the therapist going to deal with that? And that's what we, again, have been developing, you know, new techniques and ideas to get at those motivational issues, like the intimacy exercise and the feeling good together and other therapeutic techniques that we're developing to focus on the resistance, the patient's resistance to change before we come in with any techniques. And don't come in with any techniques until you've got a patient who's motivated and hungry to change their life. And if you do that, if you become more skillful with dealing with resistance, melting away the resistance, then almost any technique you come in with has a very high chance of success, and often, you know, mind-bogglingly rapid success. Now, don't get me wrong, therapy can still be challenging and difficult, but it's far, far easier, far more effective than, you know, trying to drag someone by their heels.
Just sort of out of the blue here, let me ask you, are you by any chance watching In Treatment on HBO?
No, we don't get HBO, so I've never heard of it or seen it.
Oh, my goodness. It's a wonderful series. Originally, it was a series in Israel. Then it was adapted by HBO. They're doing their second season now. But you could get the first season at your local video store on DVD, I'm pretty sure.
Is it actual therapy?
No, it's dramatizations, but it feels very... very real, very intense and very real. I think you'd have fun with it. Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there are any final thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with.
No, really. I've just loved your interview. We haven't gone too far into the techniques, but I think you've hit some really important and exciting, to me at least, aspects. And I've greatly appreciated the chance to be on your show and to kind of shoot the breeze a little bit. As you know, I really admire your interviewing style and the, it probably sounds corny to say it, but I think a real gift that you're bringing to the airways to be able to you've had so many, famous guests and prominent individuals, and I just think it's terrific that people can come to the website and begin to hear, such wonderful interviews with all the many people you've been interviewing and bring these ideas to life. And I'm just proud to be included in the mix a little bit.
Well, thank you very much for that. And as far as those specific techniques go, I really refer people to your book. They'll find them there. And we could go on a lot longer, but I don't want to test my listeners' limits too far. So, Dr. David Burns, you've been very generous with your time and your information. Thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate it.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. David Burns as interesting as I did. As sometimes happens, though, after the interview, I thought of a question I wish I had asked before we rang off. As a matter of fact, the question did occur to me during the interview, and then I promptly lost track of it. I was concerned for any listeners who might be in couples therapy currently, or who might be considering it, and I was afraid that they might take away the message from the interview that they're wasting their time. So the question would go something like this. Given the dismal record of marriage therapy that you've mentioned here, what's your advice to couples who are currently in couples therapy or who are considering it? Should they just chuck it? Now, I was tempted to email him this question as a follow-up and then read his answer here on the air. However, I think I know what he'd be likely to say, and so I'm going to hazard a guess. I think he'd say no, they should not quit couples therapy. And I can think of at least two reasons that he might bring up. First, I believe he cited a success rate in his book for couples therapy of around 50%. So that would suggest that there is at least a 50-50 chance that it will be helpful. Beyond this, I feel fairly certain that he would recommend that you take to heart his admonition to stop blaming your partner. And if both partners in the couple are willing to take this to heart, then their chances for success go way up. He might also recommend that you read his book as a way to improve your chances of relationship success. And personally, I'd second that.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, here we are again, and it's another Friday already. A sunny spring day here in Northern California. May you have blue skies wherever you are. Do you think psychologists should be able to prescribe medications? Maybe you've never thought about it, but that's the direction some psychologists have been pursuing. To find out more about the issue, you'll want to hear my interview with William Robiner, PhD, on prescription privileges for psychologists. And you'll find that on my other podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. And as always, please remember to tell your friends, your colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, your Twitter, and I seem to be gathering momentum on Twitter. You can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now we have two new additions to our Frapper map. Let me welcome into our community Suchu in Sacramento, who writes, "Hello there." Suchu saying hi to everyone on the map. And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Suchu. I believe she is of Chinese extraction. And Suchu has been sending me lots of good suggestions for the show by direct messaging me on Flickr. Or excuse me, on Twitter. So, Suchu, thanks for being so active. And I also want to extend a big welcome to Dimitris in Greece, who writes, "I am listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for the past 2 to 3 years. Interesting topics, unique guests. Dimitris, I am not sure, but I think you might be my first and perhaps only listener in Greece. If you haven't done so already, please add yourself to our Frapper map. You'll find a link on our site, a little tiny link over on the right-hand side, or you can simply go to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio. And Shrink Wrap Radio is part of the ProMed Network and also sciencepodcasters.org. By the way, if you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, it costs nothing to do so. Just means you'll get these episodes automatically delivered to you, and it helps me track the size of our audience. And the easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes. There is a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand gutter area of the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And speaking of iTunes, if you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. It keeps us on the front page of the higher education page part of the site. Have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, I think. And speaking of value, our donations have shrunk to a trickle. Please help to support this show by making a donation. You have 5 years' worth of content here. complete with over 100 transcripts. Now, I know many of you are listening on an MP3 player in your car or jogging or walking or at the gym. You are filled with good intentions, I know. Yes, you plan to make a donation. Don't lose that thought. As soon as you get back to your computer, go to shrinkwrapradio.com and click on that big green donate button. And I thank you for that right now. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals.
This is Reinhard from Austria, and you're on the couch with... Is it Dr. Jung? Or is it Dr. Freud? Dr. Adler? No, it's Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Reinhard from Austria. I got a kick out of that one. You'll recall that Reinhard recently wrote me that he was adding book recommendations in the comments area to many of the shows. Well, he's come up with another idea, which I'm enthusiastic about and hope that you will be too. Let me read one of his most recent emails. He writes, "Hi again, Dr. Dave. Today I listened to the latest 4 Shrink Wrap radio shows, so I've completed your whole back catalog. What a joyride. You go, guy." He says, "Thanks also for your mentioning my book recommendations on the show. I feel honored. Anyway, the main reason for this mail, you always say on the show that you want to create a sense of community concerning Shrink Wrap radio. I like that very much, and I'm also very fond of you reading the listener emails and reading the comments on the website. I am personally not the kind of guy who's very enthusiastic about web forums like Facebook, MySpace, or that kind. It's too much clicking and opening new windows and coming back to the site for checking new messages, etc. Maybe I'm simply too old for this kind of stuff. I don't know. On the other hand, I always liked mailing lists. So I thought, why not create a mailing list for Shrink Wrap Radio? I gather you know how a mailing list works? It's a very democratic medium. Every participant gets every mail from the other participants if the mail is sent to the main address of the list. And of course, everyone can answer each mail and the circle begins again. The beautiful thing about mailing lists is that this is a push and not a pull technology. You don't have to check sites, you just wait if there's incoming mail from the list. Very convenient. I don't know about the other listeners, but I personally think that the sense of community would be even greater if there was a kind of communication that's easygoing and easily available, like a mailing list is. It's just a shot in the dark, but maybe this could work. What do you think? And then he gives a link to https://health.groups.yahoo.com/group/shrinkwrapradio. I'm still suffering from allergies, can you tell? It's easy to subscribe, he says. Just send a mail to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com and you are on. The users can share photos, files, or links there, and you can read the link via single mail digest or on the web as you choose. I would love to participate in such a discussion group via email because some other listeners seem to be very fine and likable persons. But if you don't like this idea, I will delete this list as soon as possible. Let me know what you think of my idea and all the best with your allergies. May they vanish like the morning mist in the sunlight. Reinhard from Austria. And I do like that idea, and I'll put a link to that on the website. And I replied to Reinhard in the following terms. I said, "Hey, Reinhard, I think it's a great idea, providing you would be willing to serve as moderator. I don't have the time/energy to take on moderating, and I'm not comfortable having an unmoderated group where things can get out of hand with such things as flame wars and spam. Also, I'm not sure I would participate very much. My hands are full with podcasting, but I think it would be great if listeners wanted to dialogue and communicate in positive ways. What do you think? Let me know as soon as possible, and I'll announce it on the next show. Thanks for your support, energy, enthusiasm, and ideas." And to my email, Reinhard replied just today, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Sure, I would be willing to do that. I think the probability of flame wars is not so high on a mailing list compared to, for example, the Usenet or web communities. And the reason for that is that a mailing list is a kind of private community, and I would set the preference in such a way that only members of the list can read the messages. But if a flame war would arise, I would put these members on moderated status so I could check their mails first. And you can read along the list or not, however you wish to do. I totally understand that your time is very limited with all the work you do. Moreover, sometimes I tend to get a little bit worried about your health, putting out so many shows in such a short time. I, for myself, would love to communicate with other Shrink Wrap Radio fans, to exchange ideas, maybe interpret some dreams, discuss some shows of yours, and build a sense of community of psychology geeks from all over the world. So yeah, feel free to announce it on the next show. And if your listeners like the idea and respond well to it, maybe you could put a link on your website to the group sometime along the way. My enthusiasm is genuine because I was so excited to find Shrink Wrap Radio on the web. Listening to all your shows for the first few months gave me a surge of fresh energy for my passion for psychology and self-development. And so I want to give a little bit back to you with my support and energy because I'm very grateful for what you do. Warm regards and have a nice day, Reinhardt. So yes, I am enthusiastic about this idea as long as listeners and contributors are well behaved. You know, I've tried to set a high tone for this show, so I would ask that you refrain from vulgarities and swearing and attacking one another. Controversy in terms of debating ideas is certainly welcome, but not sort of personal attacks. And we had sort of an attempt in this direction before. Susie Swage, I think is her last name, created a Shrink Wrap Radio fan club on Facebook, and some people participated there, but it kind of died out. She didn't have time to maintain it, and I had neither time nor Facebook skills to be terribly involved. So let's give this one a try, and I will put a link on the website. If you have a pet, you know that their medications can cost you a bundle. Now you can automatically save 10% plus get free shipping on orders over $39 by following the Pet Meds link on our page at shrinkwrapradio.com. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows on the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. You can leave voice messages using the MyChingo button on our site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. David Burns, for his insights into coping with troubled relationships, and I look forward to having him on the show as a guest again in the future. I think next week my friend Jerry Trumbull and I will get back together for another show and maybe do a bit of that retrospective that we didn't do for show number 200. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.